he took another drink and dialed again. Mrs. Agnelli asks that you please stop calling. Lady Keith says to tell you to go to hell. Mrs. Guinness has requested that you no longer call. Mrs. Harriman would like you to stop phoning. Mrs. Paley is no longer taking your calls. And that's when Truman began to cry. He rolled off the chair, threw himself on the carpet, threw himself a tantrum that splashed over him like a hallucination from his childhood, drowning him with its force. And he was alone again, all alone in the dark, and the door was locked, and Mama was gone. And when would she be coming back? What if she never came back? What if he died here, alone? And then he vomited into the thick shag carpet of the tacky Beverly Hills apartment he had rented. His stomach spasmed, his throat burned as he puked vile, pink-tinged liquid all over the white carpet. And soon his face was covered in his bile, and he started to roll around in it, slathering himself with shame. And then he passed out.
Chapter 20 October 17, 1975, New York. Earlier that morning, Babe put the magazine down. Or rather, it slipped from her trembling fingers, falling to the carpeted floor. Her mouth was dry, her body shaking. She had the curious feeling of falling, even though she was sitting up straight-backed in an armchair. She gazed down at her feet. They were solidly on the ground. But still the room seemed to loom up at her, and she felt herself being weighed down by gravity so palpable she could see its mist. When she'd heard the whispers about Anne last week, that she'd swallowed cyanide pills, she hadn't believed them. Even when Elsie told Slim at the wake, "Well, Anne killed Billy, and now Truman killed Anne. So I guess that's that." Still, Babe hadn't believed it. That a woman, even tattered, self-destructive Anne Woodward, would kill herself simply because of a story? A story written by Truman? Babe couldn't comprehend it. For Truman wrote fiction, or serious nonfiction like In Cold Blood. Why on earth would Anne Woodward kill herself over something he'd written? Babe understood now. She understood humiliation and betrayal as well, but these were familiar to her. What was unfamiliar, unbelievable, was that Truman could be the one to humiliate and betray. She sat for a long while, her ears ringing with the whispers of all New York outside her window. Finally, she sipped some water until she felt she could speak in a normal tone. She would not allow her voice to quaver. She would not dissolve into tears. She was Barbara Cushing Mortimer Paley, her mother's daughter after all. When she finally felt composure settle over her like a silk shawl, she picked up the phone. "Slim? Slim, have you read the new issue of Esquire? And Truman's story?" "No." Slim sounded sleepy, and Babe realized it was rather early in the day. But first thing this morning, after another restless, sleepless night, she'd had an urgent need to read the story, and so she'd asked her maid to go out and buy an issue hot off the newsstand. Odd, she had thought at the time, that Truman hadn't sent a copy himself, as he always did. But then, he was away in California, preparing to make a cameo in a movie. Absurd to think of it, Truman in a movie. But then so many things were absurd these days. "Slim, go out right now and buy it. Then read it and call me. Call me right away." "Babe, are you all right?" "Just do as I said." Babe hung up the phone, bit her lip, reached down for the magazine, and read the thing again. It was not easy to read. She grimaced through it as she'd never grimaced through the carnage of In Cold Blood. The Clutter family's gruesome wounds had nothing on what was dripping from the pages of Truman's latest story. And the thing was, oh, the damnable thing was, Babe could hear Truman's voice in every word. Absolutely in every word, phrase, inflection. As if he were seated at her dinner table, or they were gathered around the terrace of Round Hill, or the two of them were curled up with Slim in a private cove in the garden at Kailuna, with a thermos of martinis snuck out of the house, laughing like naughty schoolchildren. Always listening to Truman talk and talk and talk. Outrageous, hysterical, but just to them. Only to them. Not to the world. Babe skimmed through the first part of the story. It wasn't that, not really. It was a poisoned pen letter, a grievance, a mockery. She skimmed through it, sucking in her breath as she read about a typical lunch at La Côte Basque. Narrated by Lady Ina Coolberth, gossipy, catty, and sounding and acting an awful lot like Slim Keith. A big, breezy, peppy broad, who happened to be married to a dull English lord, and who grew louder and drunker as the story progressed. In the story, Lady Ina gossiped and catted about a parade of the rich and famous, Jackie Kennedy looking like an exaggerated version of herself, Princess Margaret so boring she made people fall asleep, Gloria Vanderbilt so ditzy she didn't recognize her first husband. And then who should enter but Anne Hopkins? And the entire lurid Woodward tale was laid out by Truman's pen for everyone in Keokuk, Iowa. People who had no business knowing about it in the first place to salivate over. Babe winced as she read how Lady Ina wondered about Anne and her mother-in-law. What do they have to talk about when they're alone? For Slim had asked that exact same question once, long ago, in front of Truman. But it was when Truman, or rather Lady Ina, started to tell the tale of Sidney Dillon that Babe felt nauseated. She had to go to the bathroom, press a cool cloth against her head, take another drink of water before she could read the tale again. The tale of a man, a conglomerateur advisor to presidents, a Jew, the story emphasized, a man forever on the outside looking in. A man with a wife named Cleo, the most beautiful creature alive. A man who had many affairs. One in particular, a slovenly mess of a one-night stand involving bloodstains, sheets, a cool collected blonde shiksa whom he desired for the sole purpose, evidently, of making up for his Jewishness, for seeking revenge upon the Protestant world that wouldn't have him in their clubs. Seeking revenge in the most disgusting, sordid way. Babe set the magazine down once more, just as the phone rang. Babe? It was Slim, breathless, cautious. Yes. I read it. I'm horrified, beside myself. That little twerp, how dare he put such bitchy words in my mouth? How dare he make me the centerpiece, Lady Ina, my ass? It might as well say Lady Keith. Did you read the part about the man? Sidney Dillon? There was a silence, and Slim finally whispered, Yes. Who do you think it is?
I really don't know.
You don't?
I have no idea, babe.
I'm not sure who the woman in the story, the mistress, is supposed to be, but I think I know who the man could be.
Slim didn't answer for a moment. Then she began to sputter anew.
I'm so furious. I'll kill that bastard. Absolutely kill him. Just wait until everyone reads this. And Anne Woodward. Poor Anne Woodward. He murdered her, babe. That's what happened. You know she was found with the magazine in her hands?
He drove a woman to suicide, babe, and he used me to do it.
Oh, Anne.
Babe's gut took another punch. She was appalled that she'd forgotten about poor Anne and those motherless boys, orphaned boys now.
I don't know any more, Slim. I don't know how he could have done this. Why? I'm so sorry, dear, that you've been used in that way. That we all have been used. I have to go now. I'm sorry.
Babe, are you all right? Do you need me to come over?
No, I'm not all right, but I prefer to be alone now.
Babe hung up the phone, and she had never craved a cigarette in her life as she did right now. And she would have had one, too. Hang the doctors and their ridiculous worries. She was going to die, so what did it matter if she smoked once in a while? But she had thrown them all out, forbidden the household staff to smoke. And she wouldn't send anyone out to buy more. That was too desperate. Then she glanced over at the little red Moroccan pillbox. And she buried her face in her hands, remembering how Bill had found the pills, how white with fear and rage he had been when he heard her plan. So rational, she'd thought at the time. But now, now that poor Anne had done the same thing, and the way people were talking, Babe shuddered. Bill was right to have taken them from her, doling out her medicine now himself. She must spare her children and her husband that humiliation anyway. She mustn't let them be the talk of the town, like poor Anne's boys were now. But Truman hadn't been that kind, had he? And Bill. She snatched up the magazine and strode into Bill's room. He was at work, of course. She laid it on the bed where he couldn't help but see it. Then she went back to her room, lay down on her bed, sprawled on it ungainly, her face pressed deep into the pillow. And she knew her makeup would stain it beyond repair, but she didn't care. She didn't care about anything anymore. There was an ache in her chest, a hole. And for once, it wasn't the memory of what had been taken from her physically, her lungs, her future. Now it was the memory of what had been excised from her even more precisely than the surgeon's scalpel. The one relationship she thought she could count on for however much time she had left. The memories she carried with her of golden days, of communion, of a filigreed cocoon built for two. That cozy, intimate table big enough and small enough just for them. Truman and Babe. He hadn't loved her after all. He'd used her just as he used the others. She was important to him only for material. Though it wasn't true. It couldn't be true. The one person in her life whom she had trusted enough to expose herself, scars and all, her Truman. And now it was gone. All gone. Only her emptiness remained. After all the time together, all the confidences shared, the fears revealed, how had he not understood her at all? He alone saw how desperately she worked to hide the unpleasantness in her life, in herself and in her husband, to live up to the expectations bestowed upon her from birth. Truman alone knew how terrified she was of anyone seeing the truth. Anyone but him. So how could he not understand that in publicly exposing Bill's true nature, he was exposing Babe as well? He'd humiliated her beyond reason, beyond anything Bill could ever do, because Bill, for all his faults, was not a storyteller. Bill did not know how to use words to wound and expose. Now every housewife from Maine to California would read about her, Babe Paley. The woman in the fashion magazines, the epitome of all they desired to become, and see her defective, ugly, out of control. All the flaws she battled, all her life so that she could be a good girl, the perfect girl.
beautiful babe. Daddy's perfect little girl. Mama's great hope.
Babe rolled over on her side, wrapping her arms around herself for comfort, and began to rock back and forth. She heard the phone ring, and she knew who it was. But she did not leap to get it, as she always had, and knew, finally, that she never would again. Hot tears oozed out of her eyes, and she began to sob, mourning, keening. The loss of something so profound she marveled that the world outside her windows still seemed to continue on, untouched. The loss of trust, the loss of joy, the loss of herself, the loss of her true heart.
When Belle joined her for a quiet dinner in her room, she took many of her meals now on a tray, barely able to eat, although she still did her best to see that Bill's palate was continually delighted. He didn't say anything at first. Babe folded her arms and glared at him, steadily, all the while he was peppering his steak. Finally, he looked at her.
"I read it," he said.
"And?"
"If I ever see that fat little fag again, I'll kick him all the way back to Dixie."
"And?"
"I'm sorry."
Bill put the pepper grinder down with a weary sigh.
"I'm sorry, babe. I'm sorry for everything. I'm sorry you're ill. I'm sorry I'm such a bastard. I'm sorry that our friend did this to you and to me. I'm sorry I ever saw Truman Capote, allowed him on my plane that evening. I'm just sorry, all the time, every minute of the day."
"All right." That's all Babe said. That's all Bill said about the matter. They ate their dinner in silence. And they never spoke to each other of ugliness, betrayal, mistakes, or Truman Capote, ever again. The end.
Chapter 21. The next morning, Truman went to the set with a mouth so dry he could barely whisper his god-awful lines, but nobody seemed to notice. In fact, the director had already given up on him and this picture. The man simply threw up his hands and filmed what he could, which wasn't much. Truman was excused from the set and spent the rest of the afternoon composing witty telegrams and sending them off. His phone rang. All the time. And he answered with a practiced smirk, "Truman Capote, literary assassinator," which never failed to elicit a laugh. It rang and rang with the calls of gossip columnists, the booking agents for Johnny and Dick, old friends such as Mailer, asking, with fake concern, how he was holding up. It rang with the calls from the editor of Esquire, who gloated over the number of copies flying off the stands. "You'll give us another story, won't you, Truman? As soon as possible?" But Babe didn't call. Neither did Slim, nor Marella, nor Gloria, nor Pam. He had no one with whom to gush and preen and tell him he was simply the tops, true heart, really. How on earth do you do it? He had reached CZ late yesterday, and burst into tears, so relieved to have someone important, familiar and dear, answer the phone that he could scarcely articulate his joy, his appreciation, at being invited down to Palm Beach to commiserate. No. Of course, he meant celebrate. On her golden shoulder. Then he glanced at the clock. It was 9 o'clock in the evening back in New York. Well, why not give it one more try? He dialed the Paleys and, at the last minute, had the brilliant idea to ask for Bill instead of Babe. And joy of joys! He was put right through. His heart pounded so loudly in his ears he was afraid he wouldn't be able to hear a thing. But then Bill's voice said, Hello? And he sounded perfectly dry and calm. Normal. Bill, it's me, Truman, darling.
Yes?
Well, did you read it?
What?
My article. My story in Esquire. What did you think? I'm dying to know, of course. Everyone is being so coy.
I started it, Truman. But then I fell asleep. And then someone threw the magazine away while I slept.
I can get you another one, you know.
No, it's fine. I don't have time for that right now. My wife is very sick.
And then Bill hung up. His wife.
Not Babe. Not their shared dream. Not his dearest friend in the world, but simply my wife. As if Truman didn't know her at all.
Oh, the bitches. Bitches all. And he was glad, glad, glad that he'd stung them so. Look what it was doing to his career. Look at how many more people recognized him on the street.
I simply don't understand, Truman said with a sorrowful, superior sigh to Jack, to Liz Smith, to CZ, to anyone who would take his call these days, who were never the people he wanted, after all.
They knew I was the writer. They knew I'd remember everything. What did they expect? And Babe. I really thought she was smarter than that, more sophisticated. Doesn't she get it, that I love her so, even if Bill never did? And now the world knows what a bastard he is. I did it for her. Doesn't she understand that?
You did it for yourself, Truman, was all Jack replied. He never, not once, said, I told you so.
Well, so what? So what if I did? I have to look out for myself, don't I? Nobody else ever has.
And so he girded himself. He booked a facial, a manicure. He bought some new clothes and took a flight back to the East Coast, descending upon Manhattan like a potentate. Grandly, he granted interviews, cooperated with Liz Smith in her article, Truman Capote in Hot Water, and fanned the fires of scandal, dancing ever faster as the flames leapt ever higher. He lunched at La Côte Basque, accompanied by photographers. He grinned devilishly up at the camera as he brandished a knife and fork. When Esquire ran another story, Truman gleefully posed for the cover, dressed in black, pretending to file his fingernail with a stiletto. Truman Strikes Back, another excerpt from Answered Prayers. And that was it for Answered Prayers. He didn't have much of anything else written, and he knew now. He never would.
But he didn't tell anyone. Not even Jack.
His phone rang. It rang off the hook. Mostly it was people eager to tell him just whose party he hadn't been invited to.
Never mind.
He told one and all. I've been thinking of giving another party myself, you know, even better than my famous black and white ball, and this time I won't invite any of those old dinosaurs, those ancient swans. This time, baby, it's only the fabulous people. But he didn't give another ball. For some reason, all he could picture was an image of himself standing in an empty ballroom, holding a lone balloon. Who needed the plaza anyway? Truman told Johnny, told Dick, told the world. The world that still listened to him, at any rate. Why, disco was where it was at. What a thrilling, absolutely divine time to live. Truman Capote and Studio 54. Soon the names were joined together. He was just as much a fixture as Halston and Liza and Bianca. He danced until his eyes rolled back in his head while the cameras flashed away. He had sweaty sex in the basement dungeons with anonymous young centaurs who didn't hide their disgust at his bloated, decaying body. But who could be bought with handfuls of coke and a few dropped names? He told himself this was where it was at, baby. He was there, here, in, not out. He was dancing, spinning, twirling, top of the world, ma. So he wasn't invited to spend an endless,
pampered summer on Gloria's yacht anymore. Every whim catered to, Babe and Gloria and Lowell and Bill hanging on his every word, applauding, adoring. So what? So Mrs. Vreeland didn't include him in her elegant dinners any longer, although she did at least have lunch with him in her office on occasion when no one else was around. So what? So he spent too many nights passed out on his velvet couch, the television flickering ghostly images across his closed lids, dreaming of Babe. Of lying next to her in her bed, not touching, not possessing, but belonging so thoroughly that he woke up sobbing, terrified he was in one of those locked hotel rooms of his childhood, his pulse racing, his skin clammy, his mouth so dry he couldn't cry out despite the despair clawing its way out of his belly, up his throat, pounding his brain. So what? He saw the other swans sometimes. They couldn't keep him from the Met Gala, even if they tried. He'd taken an excruciating elevator ride with Gloria at Bergdorf's one day. She hadn't seen him when she got in. "Hello, Truman," she said icily. And that was that. La Guinness turned so that all he could see was her exquisite profile, her delicately etched face perched on that glorious neck. Her eyes flashed darkly. Every muscle in that neck was clenched, but she didn't say one more word. He got out on the very next floor and took another elevator back down where he ran out on the street, flung himself on the edges of the Pulitzer fountain outside the plaza. The spray of the water splotched his linen suit, and he was unable to remember why he'd gone into Bergdorf's in the first place. Then he put on his dark sunglasses and swept through the lobby of the plaza, all the way back to the Oak Room bar where he had 6 martinis and had to be poured into a cab. Once he telegrammed Slim, "Big Mama, I've decided to forgive you." Now how could she resist that? Big Mama with her sense of humor, her love for her true heart. But all he heard was silence. Everywhere he went in Manhattan, and he haunted the places he still held dear, Tiffany's and the Plaza and Bergdorf's and 21, to tell the truth, he loathed Studio 54. It was so hot, and the music hurt his ears. All he encountered were icy stares. The time-honored social cut he himself had practiced so many times. But never had Babe used it, he realized. No, Babe had been too kind ever to do that to anyone. He wondered how she was doing. He'd heard that she wasn't getting any better. He picked up the phone to call her dozens of times a day, but he always put the phone back on the receiver before he could. And then, one day, he saw her again. Chapter 22. There once was an old woman who lived in a shoe. No. This couldn't be her. The woman he saw at lunch one day at Quo Vadis. No. This couldn't possibly be his Bobolink. Not this frail, terribly aged creature who was so thin the clothes, for the first time in her life, did not look fabulous. No amount of expensive tailoring could make this woman look as if she belonged in anything but a hospital gown. But it was Babe, after all. Her beauty still shone gallantly through the grim mask of pain, and Truman, who had been lunching alone, none of his new friends ever got up before 3 in the afternoon, felt his heart beat wildly at the sight of her. For the first time in months, he felt whole, perfect, and beautiful as he once had been with her. "Hello, Babe." He rose, his napkin clutched in his sweaty hand. Babe paused. She was with her sister, Betsy, who looked down at Truman as if she might want to eat him. "Hello, Truman." Babe didn't look at him. She didn't break into the joyful, delighted smile that he had been used to seeing. Once upon a time.
Babe, I did it for you.
He found himself blurting out, even if she didn't appear to want to know anything further about him other than what he was eating for lunch.
I only did it for you. I thought you should know.
Babe cast her glorious eyes downward. He saw her shoulders tremble before she gathered herself. When she raised her face to him, she was herself once more, his. His beautiful babe. The only woman, hell, the only person, he realized with a jolt, that he had ever loved, even more than his mama. Babe's eyes, for just that moment, were completely sympathetic. Aware, full of knowledge, knowledge he alone had imparted, a secret code between best friends. Her eyes were warm and grateful.
I know,
she whispered, turning away from Betsy, her voice intended for only his ears. He had to lean in to hear.
I know, and thank you.
He wasn't sure he'd heard it right. He thought he had. He wished he had. Dear God, let this be true forever and ever, amen. But she was already gone, gliding away, pulled by her sister, elegant as always, although very slow, each step deliberate. A defiant act of living, her back was straight, formidable. She never turned to look at him, and so he wasn't sure.
After all, babe,
he whispered. And it was like before. He was sure she would hear him above the din of people laughing and chatting and stop, pick him out, come back for him, take him with her. But she didn't. He turned around, blindly, and felt hot, disapproving stares burning into his flesh. His ears buzzed with hissing and sneers, taunting, dismissive. Truman plopped back down, knocking over a water glass, sending cutlery falling softly to the plush carpet. His heart slowed, but now his lungs seemed to be working overtime. He was cold and clammy, listing to the right, then to the left, as helplessly as if he were on choppy water, unmoored, unloved. And to his astonishment, he burst into tears, sloppy, messy tears, and whispered, a cry from the tattered heart that he hadn't understood he'd possessed until now.
Babe, babe, babe.
And then the maitre d' was grabbing his arm, holding him up and escorting him from the restaurant, trying to shield him from the stairs. The proprietor mumbled something about taking care of the bill, but Truman didn't care. He knew that he would never see her again.
Chapter 23. And they lived happily ever after. Who did? Who the hell did? Babe wanted to know, on the days when she felt strong enough for outrage. Because she didn't. She sure as hell didn't. Life was no fairy tale, no matter what her mother had told her. She had no prince to kiss her, to wake her up from this nightmare. She'd had a prince, once. It wasn't the tall man, stooped now, his shoulders hunched always with regret, with thinning silver hair, who sat by her bed and held her hand and sloppily cried on it. No, Bill wasn't her prince, and had he ever been? Maybe once. When he promised her salvation in the form of riches, a fabulous partnership designed to be the envy of all. Maybe then. When riches and prestige were the only things that mattered to her. When she was still her mother's daughter. But then she met another. A fair-haired prince. Her true love. And they told each other all their secrets, bared to each other their souls, and were going to live happily ever after together. They'd even talked about it. How she'd most likely outlive Bill, and so the two of them would live together, become one of those touching older couples who still held hands, still danced in the evening when the shadows were long, while a scratchy phonograph played the Tennessee Waltz. That was the story they told each other. After the first story, the story of how they met was no longer sufficient. When the future was closer than the past, but no less golden. But now she was dying, and Bill was the one who would remain. And Truman could not be by her side, holding her hand, even though she longed for his touch. Cried out for it, she feared, when she was not herself. When the medicine could not ease the pain, the terror of not being able to draw breath, of being suffocated. She wanted Truman in the same way she'd wanted her father when she was little, when she was scared, when she knew something ominous and terrifying was looming, and she was too small by herself. But she couldn't have Truman. She wouldn't have Truman. Truman had betrayed her, betrayed Bill, betrayed the family they had created. We stick together. We don't air our dirty laundry. Family is first. Family is everything. Her mother's words still trumped all. All feeling, all impulse, all longing, all compassion. Because deep in her heart, Babe knew something else, too. We betrayed him, she told Slim on one of her good days, when she was able to sit up against the pillows, wear one of her beautiful quilted satin bed jackets, have a visitor for a precious few minutes. One of the days when the medicine didn't dull her senses and put her under so deeply that she had no idea what day it was, even if it was day or night, if she was 5 or 25 or 55, if she was Alice through the looking glass, or Tweedledum or Tweedledee, if she was healthy or ill. What on earth are you talking about, Babe? Slim sat in a chair next to Babe's bed. Her hands twitched, not sure what to do without the usual cigarette. Babe always insisted that her guests be treated as of old, but most were too polite to smoke in her presence. So Slim examined her manicure instead and frowned at Babe. What the hell do you mean, Babe?
I think part of the whole thing was that he was testing us. Testing us to make sure we loved him, really loved him. Because true love means forgiving no matter what. And we failed him. We didn't love him that way.
Nonsense. You did.
I did. But maybe I didn't. Not enough. Maybe I never could love anyone, truly. Maybe I'm just not capable.
Babe's eyes were dry, her voice weak but steady. She was not seeking sympathy, Slim understood. She was quietly stating a fact of her life, a fact that she must have suffered hell to conclude. Her friend had gone through the trials of Hades lately. Maybe she'd gone through them all her life but never let on. Because, of course, she wouldn't. Babe Paley could never reveal that her life was anything but enviable.
I think you're wrong, Babe. Don't make excuses for Truman. That bastard doesn't deserve it.
Yes, he does. We all do, Slim. You'll understand one day.
Babe leaned back and closed her eyes. Slim wondered if she should leave her.
I have everything planned, you know.
Babe murmured, opening her eyes, even more solemn and thoughtful now that they could see beyond the physical plane.
What do you mean? My funeral. The reception after. The menu is already planned. The flowers, everything. I couldn't leave that for Bill. or my children. They shouldn't have to worry about all that. So I left everything with my secretary, but I wanted you to know, too. She has all the details. The caterers and florists have already been notified.
Christ, babe.
Slim was shaking. Babe smiled and reached out her hand. Slim grasped it blindly.
It's fine, Slim. I wanted to do it. It seemed right. The best way. I'm a doctor's daughter, remember? I know what's happening, what will happen. I have no illusions about death. We do what we have to do, what's right and important, while we're living, not after.
Slim inhaled. A big, sloppy, phlegm-soaked breath. She started coughing, a true fit, and had to have a glass of water. When finally the fit was over, and her chest hurt and her eyes were streaming, she saw that Babe was laughing quietly.
I'm the one who's supposed to do that,
she teased, with that rare twinkle in her eye, the twinkle that Truman had so often brought out to the surprise and delight of all.
Not you. I'm going to miss you,
Slim blurted out, then clasped her hand to her mouth, horrified for saying it.
I know.
Babe nodded and seemed relieved to hear it.
But you'll be fine, Slim. That's one thing I know about you. You're a survivor.
Slim left Babe then, after a kiss to her smooth, moisturized, made-up cheek, and a whisper to, "Get some sleep, dear." But as she went down the hall, stopping first to see Bill, who was slumped in an armchair outside Babe's room, kissing him as well, embracing him as if the big, rangy man was a child, clutching him to her chest for a few moments, while they both murmured soothing, nonsensical words. She wondered what Babe had meant by that.
"You're a survivor," Babe had said, and there was no emotion in her voice at all.
None of the tears that Slim had shed upon hearing it.
What did she mean?
Slim told herself she'd never know. Even as she felt a tickle of fear race up and down her spine. She turned to Bill, thought about asking him, but knew that now was not the time. Bill was a broken man, crumbled by enough guilt to bring down the Empire State Building.
No need to pile on.
She would not be that woman, the kind of woman who made someone else's tragedy all about herself. There would be plenty of time for wondering once it was all over.
Too much time.
Too much time without Babe, without Truman, without kindness and elegance, and, oh, Christ, the laughter.
A dull, dismal lifetime. Babe woke up one morning knowing that she wouldn't wake up again. It had been too much effort to swim up from the darkness, and she didn't welcome consciousness and one more glimpse of the sun. One more day lying like a specimen, her family hovering over her, counting every single breath she managed to take. So she gestured to a nurse who understood. The nurse brought her a tray filled with her cosmetics, a small mirror on a stand, and Babe Paley did her makeup one last time, with the same calming sense of ritual she'd always had when she'd looked in the mirror, starting first with the foundation, applied with a sponge, so shakily now. The sponge weighed like a heavy stone in her translucent fingers, although she couldn't really feel it, as her extremities were cold and numb. But she didn't flinch from the mirror, from the ravaged remnants of a person staring back. She knew she could conceal the damage, the flaws, and emerge beautiful. The butterfly from the chrysalis one last time. She had to pause and take long gasps from the oxygen mask. She had to rest between applications, between the foundation and then the blush, and then the concealer, and then the eyeshadow, the intricately applied layers, and then the liner, which, with a grim determination, a gritting of her teeth, she managed to quiet her shaking hands long enough to apply flawlessly, the line straight and smooth. And she lay the liner brush down with a sigh and felt as if she'd won a battle. The last battle. Now she was ready. Now they could all come in. Bill and Tony and Amanda and Bill Jr. and Kate. The bald little girl whom her mother could barely look at, because her own flaws were on flagrant display in this child. Kate was now an angry young woman, and Babe sensed that she didn't want to be there because she still couldn't forgive her mother for her neglect. And Babe didn't blame her. Babe really didn't care who was standing vigil around her deathbed. But she knew that Kate would regret it forever if she hadn't been there. Babe remembered sitting by her mother's bed when Goggs passed away. She had felt so very detached and even resentful, but still, it had been the right thing to do. "Where's Truman?" She heard the words, and since she was too tired to speak them, they must have escaped from her heart. She was so very tired now, so weary, so done with it all. They were all there, but she had never felt so alone. Not since before. No one answered, and Babe had to wonder if anyone else had heard the question. She shouldn't have asked it. She didn't mean to. She shouldn't let them all see how much she needed him. This was their moment. Her husband's, her children's. She saw them through fluttering eyelids. Their eyes were red, their expressions numb. She felt them pressing around her, holding her hands, touching her shoulder. But still, they weren't enough. She was cold. She was drifting. She was alone. So alone. And then she was nothing.
For hours, Bill sat holding his wife's hand. The children drifted in and out, but he remained. Bill Paley, titan of the boardroom, king of the airways. He sat, holding his wife's chill, fragile hand, long after she had stopped breathing. She still looked beautiful, like a Modigliani, an Italian sculpture etched in marble. She'd died hating him, he knew. Hating him, but loving Truman. But granting him the privilege of a grieving husband, one last time covering for him and his sins, allowing the world to see him as who he wanted to be, and not who he was. That was Babe, he thought, graciously and thoughtfully arranging his life to the very end. Chapter 24 Truman read of her death in the Times. Barbara Cushing Paley dies at 63, style pace-setter in 3 decades, symbol of taste. When he read it, he had to smile. She would certainly be pleased, for despite her protests, Bobolink had reveled in her image, had worked hard at it, harder than he had ever worked on a book in his life. Every minute of every hour of every day was spent cultivating her style, perpetuating the myth. And he had always admired that about her, even when Jack and others decried it as shallow and pointless. "You don't understand," he'd always said, defending her. "She's an artist like you, like me. She dedicates her life to creating beauty.
It just happens that the product is herself instead of a canvas, or a sculpture, or a poem. What's wrong with that?
They'd never understood. His artist friends, his fellow authors, the ones he'd met back at the beginning at Iago, the dreary, serious souls who couldn't afford lunch at Quo Vadis unless their publishers were paying. His contemporaries, as they insisted on being called. But then they never understood Truman either. They were jealous, that's all, envious, green with it, absolutely emerald.
He knew Babe was dying. Hadn't he resigned himself to the fact that they wouldn't reconcile? Hadn't he taken it like a good, stoic little boy? Hadn't he stopped calling, stopped telegraphing, letting her die in peace? Hadn't he known he wouldn't be invited to the funeral, and had determined to spend that day in quiet reflection in his apartment, surrounded by the things she'd bought him over the years? The antique paperweights for his collection, a painting here, a bibelot there, the oriental rug in the foyer, the ruby cufflinks, the silly, thoughtful little things that amused him, like the scarf printed with tiny little Elvises holding guitars, because Truman had once rolled his eyes and growled, "That boy from Memphis really gets my motor running." But when the day arrived, he couldn't get out of bed. He felt crushed by a despair more enormous than his good intentions. He watched those intentions fly right out the window, weightless, fluttering, silly little things, chased away by the rhinoceros that settled on his chest. So he reached for a drink. The vodka bottle was on the nightstand. Soon he'd had enough to enable him to shove that rhinoceros off the bed, throw on some clothes, cover himself in a black opera cloak. And in a corner of a drawer, a flash of color caught his eye. It was the orange flower he'd bought at the market in Jamaica that wonderful, glorious day with her when the sky was azure. The sun was a luscious, golden dream, and everyone was smiling, bright white teeth flashing, the air scented with jasmine, and Babe's perfume. What was it again? Oh, yes. Vin vert. That grassy, crystalline fragrance. Truman's hands shook as he picked up the flower, now faded, the edges frayed. He pinned it to the cloak with fat, fumbling fingers. He stuck his forefinger with the pin and sucked the droplet of blood, tasteless. He thought, only mildly curious, "My blood has no taste. I have pickled it beyond its essence." Then he stumbled out the door, into the elevator, and into the arms of the doorman. He mumbled that he needed a taxi.
"Where to?"
inquired the doorman.
"Manhasset."
"Long Island?"
"Where else?"
The doorman shrugged, picked up a phone, and in 5 minutes a taxi was at the door. Truman handed the man a wad of cash and croaked, "Christ Episcopal Church in Manhasset." The driver pocketed the money and they drove off. Once in a while he looked in his rear-view mirror, unsure if his passenger was or was not Truman Capote. The bloated, pink face, the outrageous black hat, black opera cloak, flaming flower, they sure looked like something a fag would wear. But the eyes were obscured by dark round glasses, so he didn't know for sure.
"Hey, are you Truman?"
He couldn't stand it. He had to know.
"Yes,"
Truman lisped exaggeratedly, like a snake hissing. "Yes, I sure am."
"Thought so."
And the cabbie left him in silence the entire way, except for when Truman asked him to stop at a liquor store and he said,
"Sure thing,"
and waited while Truman lurched inside, only to emerge with a bottle of vodka.
"Proceed,"
Truman instructed. So they did.
"What's the traffic for?"
the cabbie asked,
When finally they drew near the church fronting a tree-lined street, packed with limousines and town cars and cabs.
Is it a wedding?
No. Truman told the cab to stop and wait. Then he got out, still grasping the bottle. He looked about, furtively. He seemed to tuck his head into his cloak like a turtle, and he sank back into the embrace of a wisteria tree. The cabbie rolled down his window. It was hot, this July of 1978. And he wondered how Truman could stand the heavy cloak. Truman, safely hidden, watched as they gathered on the sidewalk in front of the church, embracing, air-kissing, dabbing eyes. There was Diana, the divine Mrs. V, in a fabulous long-sleeved, embroidered dress with a dragon-red mandarin collar. There were Betty Bacall, Kay Graham, Kenneth himself, and, of course, all his swans, Slim and Marilla and Gloria and Pam and CZ. Those bitches. Those glorious creatures. Oh, what were they talking about? Were they mourning Babe? Had they ever mourned him as he mourned them? And did they hate him as he hated them for being so stupid, so breathtakingly idiotic, as to not understand who he was after all? I made you all, he whispered, the words as tart upon his tongue as his blood had been bland. You were just material, and I fooled you. I fooled you all. As he watched them air-kiss and shake their glorious heads, goodness, Gloria's turban was absolutely to die for. He could see the ostrich-egg-sized jewel all the way over here. It was like his ball all over again, all the same players, only this time. Everyone was wearing black. A black ball. And he was blackballed. Truman giggled. And drank more, and his stomach was like a vat of gurgling lava, everything bubbling up and over, and he belched. Hiding it behind his hand, even though he was across the street and in a bush and nobody could see him. And then he saw the casket come out. And Bill was following it, his hands clasped in front of him, his head bowed. And Truman studied him for a moment, silently applauding his performance. The man did look devastated, he'd give him that. He wondered if the bastard would pick up someone at the funeral reception. But then Truman forgot Bill, and vowed that he never would again think of him, Big Bill, the great white father. Instead he watched the casket, very small, covered in flowers, carried on the shoulders of men he couldn't identify from so far away, presumably Babe's nephews and cousins. The casket was his only focus. And inside it was the very best part of him, and he knew it would be buried deep within the ground, and soon it would be autumn, then winter, and snow would fall upon it, covering all traces of the only good thing that had ever happened to him. He heard sounds coming from deep within himself. Moans. Songs of sadness, broken lullabies as he rocked back and forth, registering finally the loss of love, the shattered romance of it, the tragic ending handed to him by fate and disease. It wasn't his fault. It wasn't hers. It was simply the universe deciding to tear them apart. Like all great lovers, Romeo and Juliet, Tristan and Isolde, Truman and Babe. And it was hell now, knowing that he wasn't invited, wasn't asked to say goodbye, and it was the same old thing, the same well-worn record played over and over and over, that he wasn't good enough, wasn't man enough, wasn't enough for her, after all. for anybody. Look at him, standing here crying all by himself, pissing himself, choking on vodka and tears, all alone again. Still. Forever. Truman watched as the casket was loaded in